This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall. The new coronavirus continues its cruel attack on the world with no sign it is slowing down. It has made its feared presence known in 177 countries and regions. There are nearly 615,000 confirmed cases worldwide, with close to 29,000 deaths. The figures come from a Johns Hopkins University running tally. That count shows the United States with the largest number of confirmed infections, about 105,000, and around 1,600 deaths. New York City is especially hard hit with an explosive growth in hospital admissions. But there are major concerns over large new clusters showing up in Chicago, Detroit, and New Orleans. In Detroit, more than a fifth of the police force is quarantined. Two officers have died from the coronavirus, and at least 39 have tested positive, including the chief of police. Growing numbers of police departments around the country are watching their ranks being depleted by the virus as cases spread across the U.S. In Europe, Italy and Spain are still recording death spiral numbers, which have been accelerating. 2 weeks into a nationwide lockdown, Italy has lost more than 9,000 lives to the virus. Italian officials cited almost 1,000 new cases over 24 hours, pushing the country's total caseload to about 86,500. In Spain, the number of coronavirus cases is over 72,000. Deaths are approaching 6,000. Says a paramedic in Barcelona, "We are completely overwhelmed." In France, COVID-19 has claimed about 2,000 lives. 33,000 people are known to be infected. French health workers got a bright display of gratitude overnight, emblazoned in lights in the Eiffel Tower, "Merci." Also spelled out in French was "Stay at home." Germany says it's keeping its restrictions on public life in place until at least April 20th. There have been 53,000 COVID-19 cases in Germany, with about 400 deaths. Chancellor Angela Merkel remains quarantined. She was treated by a doctor later found to be coronavirus positive. This is VOA News. Hard-hit Iran, a Middle East COVID-19 hotspot, has reported over 35,000 cases with a death toll of more than 2,500. A tragedy on top of that. Nearly 300 people in Iran have died after ingesting methanol, which they thought, apparently, was a virus therapeutic. India is using a fleet of buses to carry an exodus of migrant workers home from New Delhi to their home villages in the midst of the world's largest lockdown of 1.3 billion people. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says his country has reached a critical stage in dealing with the pandemic, but that he is not yet prepared to declare a state of emergency. China is sending medical help and supplies to neighboring Pakistan. There have been only 11 virus deaths there, but there are more than 1,400 cases. U.S. President Donald Trump has signed a $2.2 trillion pandemic aid package aimed at helping Americans weather a period of economic distress that deepens by the day. Businesses large and small will also share in the cash to be handed out in loans and grants. After long refusing to do it, Mr. Trump has invoked the Defense Production Act, ordering General Motors to begin making ventilators, increasingly needed to keep COVID-19 patients alive. The state of New York alone wants tens of thousands of the machines for its hospitals. An official at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control says the country remains in the acceleration phase of the pandemic and that all corners of the United States are at risk. It's an argument clearly at odds with President Trump's public wish to soon open up the economy in parts of the country which remain largely untouched by COVID-19. He's promising an early decision on backing away from existing White House guidance on such things as stay-at-home orders and social distancing. Abbott Labs says it's gotten approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to market a rapid test for detecting the coronavirus. 5 minutes for a positive result, 13 minutes for a negative reading. Because of the pandemic, a conference to review the implementation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty has been postponed. It was set to begin at UN headquarters in New York late next month. The meeting is held every 5 years. The treaty is considered the underpinning of global efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. 191 nations are involved. Sources say a retired Venezuelan army general indicted with embattled President Nicolas Maduro has surrendered in Colombia and that he is being taken by drug enforcement agents to New York for arraignment. Cliver Alcala has been an outspoken critic of Maduro for years, but he was charged Thursday with helping Maduro and others in a narco-terrorist conspiracy. American prosecutors say the operation shipped 250 metric tons of cocaine a year to the U.S. and turned the Venezuelan state into a platform for violent cartels and Colombian rebels. More news at voanews.com online. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The Malawi Electoral Commission is hoping and believing that we'll have the necessary tools and the financial backing. However, with the outbreak of coronavirus, we may have a challenge.
The Malawi Electoral Commission begins preparations to organize the upcoming presidential election rerun.
The People's Democratic Party considers such a reaction as misplaced. And we say it is misplaced because all we are asking for is that Mr. President should come and address Nigerians, should give Nigerians a reassurance and provide leadership for the people.
The Nigerian main opposition party denies it is using the coronavirus to score political points.
Yes, we are calling on the president to consider pardoning prisoners that have committed minor offenses. Well, we do understand that prisoners are supposed to be in confinement, but we have seen situations in this country where prisoners are allowed to go and work outside their confinement.
And a Zambian opposition leader calls on President Edgar Lungu to decongest the prisons as part of the effort to combat the coronavirus pandemic. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The chairperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission says the organization has begun preparations ahead of the scheduled July 2 presidential election rerun. Dr. Justice Jane Ansah says the electoral body is engaging all stakeholders, including the political parties, to address their concerns before the vote. The chairperson is coming under pressure from political and civil society groups. This after the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC, a political pressure group, organized a series of nationwide demonstrations demanding her ouster. Backed by opposition political parties and civil society groups, the HRDC demanding that the head of the Electoral Commission step down or be fired by the president. They accuse her of bungling last year's general election. Meanwhile, Dr. Justice Jane Ansah, chairperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission, tells me the electoral body has the much-needed funds to organize the upcoming poll.
Yes, we are. The Malawi Electoral Commission is hoping and believing that we'll have the necessary tools and the financial backing. Government has already committed to giving us so much of our budget, and we are still talking to the development partners, and our discussions appear to be positive. We believe we'll have the necessary tools as far as the money is concerned. However, with the outbreak of coronavirus, we may have a challenge, especially when it comes to voting materials like ballot paper, indelible ink. Malawi does not have a security printer. Therefore, printing is always done outside Malawi. And with the shutdown that is going on around the world and the stopping of flights, we may have a challenge in that area. And even if we had local suppliers, we do not have companies that manufacture the voting materials that we need. They still import from China and other places. So with the shutdown, that will be our main challenge.
Well, with this challenge, how does the Malawi Electoral Commission plan to surmount this challenge? And do you think you would have the necessary time resolving all these challenges before the July 2 presidential election rerun?
As you are aware, that the judgment order that we are complying with is a high court order. That judgment has been appealed against in the Supreme Court. I mean, the hearing is on 15th April. There are areas of the law, especially, that need to be clarified. And we believe that after the hearing, we will have a clear view of which way to go. Since it is on the 15th, it also gives us a time to prosecute our appeal and expect some orders from the Supreme Court that will give clarity and chart the way forward. So we are complying with the High Court judgment, but the terrain may change with the judgment of the Supreme Court. Having said that, we are just playing by the ear, hoping that the coronavirus will be over by maybe end of April, since most nations have given it up to 2-3 months, and that everything will be back to normal when we can have the fresh elections.
How does the Malawi Electoral Commission plan to resolve concerns of opposition parties, particularly those in the alliance, since they were very critical about how the Malawi Electoral Commission organized the annulled presidential election last year?
The Malawi Electoral Commission, in complying with the court order, we have looked at the areas that were faulted and we have corrected those areas. To begin with, the judgment found that the correction fluid called known as the TPEX was not used to the advantage of a particular candidate or to the disadvantage of any candidate. Secondly, it was also found that there was no evidence to show that there was a fraud. So the understanding is that the finding of the court is that the correction fluid, TPEX, was not used for rigging or for fraud. But the Malawi Electoral Commission was faulted on the application of the law and interpretation of the law. Section 80, subsection 2 of the Constitution makes a provision that the president shall be elected by the majority of the electorate of voters. Now, the High Court, sitting as a constitutional court, found that faulted make for declaring the president as the winner when he got 38.59%, it found that the MEC should have declared the president the winner only when he had scooped 50+1% of the votes. That is a new interpretation of Section 8, Subsection 2, because the same section was interpreted in 1999 by the Supreme Court, which said majority means first past the post. The other area that the MEC was voted on the application of law, it used the constituency tally centers when they are not provided for in the law, and also delegating powers to the chief elections officer to do certain things that was also voted. The other point, legal point, is that the law envisages two books, but we had one booklet. That booklet, on one side, it was containing the summary of the results, and on the other side, complaints. You will notice that it is pertinent to mention that for the MEC to get to use a constituency tally center and also to use one book for the two items, it was discussed with the stakeholders and it was agreed upon. So we went according to the agreement. Of course, we looked at the law. The law allows the MEC to adopt anything that will enhance the integrity of the election. So we used that section, but we were faulted. So this time around, we have resolved to apply the law as it is, irrespective of what stakeholders or political parties say. So we believe, since we were mostly voted on the law and not on the rigging as it was alleged before, we have the support, the blessing of the opposition parties and all parties.
Talking about transparency and integrity of this coming election, will all the stakeholders be briefed about your plans in terms of measures you are implementing with respect to the law, in order not for other questioning and motives alleged of bias in the run-up to this election?
Yes, concerning integrity and sharing with the stakeholders what MEC is doing, that we are already doing. Two Fridays ago, we called all stakeholders. We first met CMD, which is the Center for Multi-Party Democracy, and the members to that institution, their political parties. And when there's an election, and also representatives of those that are interested to participate. So when we met the CMD, we gave our report, which actually looked at the judgment, the impact of the judgment, and the order of the court, and our understanding of the judgment. They had the time to ask questions, we discussed. In the end, we saw that they were understanding, we were not far apart. After that, we called a larger group of all stakeholders. This includes representatives of political parties, CSOs, civil society organizations, faith-based groups, government development partners, and others, all people that are affected in one way or another by elections. These are stakeholders. We shared also, we gave them the report of the judgment, how we understand it, the orders, and what law we are going to apply, since the law is the same old law. If the law changes, we told them, we are going to apply that law, and how visible it will be to have the elections on 19th, since it is a law, will abide. But at the same time, we shared with them that the matter is before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court may give further orders. And should the Supreme Court give further orders, then we will go by what the Supreme Court says. So we are not doing anything in hiding, in secret, as it has always been our way of working. We have always worked with the stakeholders. We have updated them of each and every stage we are, a decision we take, what we are doing, they know. And in fact, MEC is very, very transparent. And we think it is this transparent, which is maybe over transparency, that has really contributed to all this, what we are going through now. So because of the coronavirus directives, that we cannot meet more than 100 people, we scaled down on how many people will be present at the launch. We started with members of the press, because then they are going to take that launch statement and broadcast it to the whole country. And later this week, we are meeting the CMD and also all the stakeholders. We are going to share with them the calendar, the electoral calendar that we have come up with.
What assurances are you giving the people of Malawi about the credibility of this
upcoming presidential election rerun.
The assurances we are giving the Malawi of the credibility of this coming election is that this election, it shall be free and transparent, cost-effective, and we are doing the best within the allocated time by the court. And we ensure that there's credibility when we involve all stakeholders. All stakeholders will be involved in that. They will not be left behind. They will be updated from time to time. They will know where we are, what we are doing. We will be working together with them. Transparency and working together with the stakeholders will bring credibility. And because they will participate and see what is happening.
Dr. Jessie Jane Ansah is the chairperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission. She spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, has sharply denied accusations that it is using the ongoing coronavirus crisis in the country to score political points. Kola Olugbodiyan, spokesperson for the party, says President Muhammadu Buhari should address the nation about his administration's efforts to combat the disease from spreading to the population. He also says the president has failed to explain his plans for ending the spread of the disease. Supporters of the ruling party, however, rejected the opposition party's criticisms as opportunistic and unpatriotic. They also say that Nigerians are well aware of the measures the administration has been implementing to reduce the spread of the disease. PDP spokesperson Kola Olugbodiyan tells me the failure of President Buhari to address the nation is regrettable and unfortunate. This, he says, does not inspire confidence among Nigerians and an indication of poor leadership.
The People's Democratic Party considers such a reaction as misplaced. And we say it is misplaced because all we are asking for is that Mr. President should come and address Nigerians, should give Nigerians a reassurance and provide leadership for the people. And for Mr. President Muhammadu Buhari to lead the battle against coronavirus from the front. Unfortunately, Mr. President has refused to address Nigerians. He has not appeared in a public space in more than a week. Talk less of addressing or speaking to Nigerians in respect of coronavirus.
Femi Adesina, one of his spokesmen, said that it is a matter of style for the president to address or not to address the nation, and that health officials are implementing measures to combat the spread of COVID-19. What is your take on that?
It is not a matter of style for Mr. President not to address Nigerians and provide leadership and lead from the front in the battle against coronavirus. Rather, it is a dereliction of duty. It is an abandonment of the people at their crucial time of need. I do not agree with Mr. Adesina that it's a matter of style for the president to be missing in action at a time when Nigerians are worried, when Nigerians are depressed, when Nigerians are scared of the import of coronavirus. I think Mr. President will do his government a lot of good. I think Mr. President will be more responsive to the people if he comes out and stay behind and stay on the camera and address Nigerians.
Well, some people have said that the president has proven beyond all shadow of doubt that he is in touch with Nigerians, and that reports that his chief of staff and some officials in his administration tested positive. That is why the president got tested for the coronavirus. His test result came out negative and was broadcast to the whole nation to show that he is indeed monitoring the situation and giving direction as to how officials can cooperate to fight this disease. Some Nigerians are saying this is enough. What is your response to that?
Majority of Nigerians do not agree with that line of thought that Mr. President has done enough through the revelation that his chief of staff has tested positive and he has tested negative. Neither Mr. President nor his chief of staff, Madam Abba Kyari, has spoken to Nigerians, had addressed Nigerians on even the test. All we are hearing, all we are reading, are hearsay from the staff of the presidency. And our position in PDP, our argument in the PDP, our call in the PDP is for Mr. President Muhammadu Buhari to address Nigerians on the effort that his government is making and on the ways that coronavirus will be fought. What Nigerians are demanding for is that Mr. President should lead from the front and should provide leadership by giving assurances to a despairing people that they have a future and that the future holds great for them. And it should be seen as working and collaborating with international organizations to ensure that coronavirus does not ravage our people. This is just the demand of the People's Democratic Party.
So what do you say to officials of the government who are saying that the health officials and the health ministry working with those at the front lines battling the disease and trying to contain it from spreading out are doing their work, and their work is being known by all Nigerians across the country? So demanding the president to address the nation, they said, is politically motivated just to score cheap political point using this pandemic. What is your reaction to that?
Is that what obtains in other parts of the world? Does that conform with international best practices? In other countries where the presidents are coming out to address their citizens, are there no health workers in those countries? Why is it difficult for the Nigerian president to give assurances to his citizens? Why is it difficult for Mr. President to lay out plans and address Nigerians in respect of such plans? It's rather unfortunate, and the People's Democratic Party will not mince words in saying that Mr. President needs to address Nigerians, and we call him out to address Nigerians on the efforts of his government in the fight against coronavirus.
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition party, People's Democratic Party, or PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The leader of the Zambian Opposition People's Alliance for Change, or PAC, PAC, is calling on President Edgar Lungu to pardon some prison inmates with minor offenses who do not pose any danger to society. This, the leader says, should form part of the government's strategy to combat the spread of the coronavirus. Andy Ford Mayele Banda says the country's overcrowded prisons could be a fertile ground for the spread of the disease. He further stated that prevailing hygienic conditions are poor and should be addressed quickly due to the ongoing pandemic. His remarks follow recommendations from the government to combat the spread of the virus. But Mr. Banda says some overpopulated prisons may not be able to use some of the measures to fight the disease, such as social distancing, due to the overcrowded prisons. For more about his call on the president to pardon some of the prisoners, I reach Andy Ford Mayele Banda, leader of the People's Alliance for Change, or PAC, in the capital, Lusaka.
Yes, we are calling on the president to consider pardoning prisoners that have committed minor offenses. Well, we do understand that prisoners are supposed to be in confinement, but we have seen situations in this country where prisoners are allowed to go and work outside their confinement, meaning that time and again, the prisoners, they get in touch with the outside world. So there is a risk of them being contaminated with the coronavirus if they are in touch with the outside world. Apart from that, the people that supervise them, who are called the prison warders, they are in touch with the outside world. So we believe that should there be an outbreak of the coronavirus in the prisons, the situation can be catastrophic. In addition to that, the current hygiene levels in most correction facilities do not help in preventing the spread of the virus. The hygiene levels are so bad. Hence, we believe that pardoning a few prisoners, it would be helpful, in preventing this virus in the prisons.
Some are suggesting that pardoning a few prisoners will not necessarily have any impact on the fight against the spread of the disease. What is your reaction to that?
From the lessons that we've learned across the world, we have seen that the outbreak can happen from anywhere. So our proposal to decongest the prisons is to try and ensure that everything is done in every corner or in every area to prevent the outbreak of the virus. We have proposed measures to be taken in markets, which are still open. We have proposed measures to be taken in bus stations, which are still open. We've also proposed measures to be taken in other areas where there's still traffic. That includes the prisons. So definitely, we have to ensure that something is done in every area to avoid any catastrophe from happening.
What do you say to supporters of the Patriotic Front, the ruling party, who are saying that the government is on top of issues? The government has issued measures and educating the masses and all that. What do you say to them?
To start with, I would like to caution the PF cadres or PF supporters not to go along with the same propaganda they have played on every issue that has affected our country, mostly negatively. The coronavirus is a serious issue and propaganda won't help us. While we do support government efforts in trying to contain the virus, we have seen that there's still a number of areas that are still lagging behind. The other day, we were donating hand wash basins, hand sanitizers, and sensitizing the public on the need to take this disease serious. And we did notice that there's inadequate information out there, especially in markets and bus stations. Therefore, we would like to call upon the government to ensure that adequate information is disseminated in markets, bus stations, and high-density populated areas.
So what do you say to your critics who are saying that your call is politically motivated just to ensure that your party stays relevant in this COVID-19 case as your government in Lusaka battles the spread of the disease?
The critics can only come from the irrelevant PF cadres or PF members who feel insecure by any contribution that is made by the opposition in this country. Over the days, we had been calling on the president, who has been silent, to address the nation, just as many leaders are doing it across the globe in this time of the coronavirus. But the same PF members who support everything and anything were saying that the president did not need to address the nation. Finally, the president hid our call to address the nation yesterday, and they were so ashamed. So what we have learned to do is to ignore these irrelevant PF members because we believe they're not interested in the progress of our country, Zambia.
Andy Ford Mayele Banda is the leader of the Zambian Opposition People's Alliance for Change, or PAC. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Opposition leaders in Tanzania are criticizing the government's response to the coronavirus after President John Magufuli said he will never close down places of worship. Critics worry the East African nation's 13 confirmed cases of coronavirus could quickly multiply in crowded churches. For VOA, Charles Kombe reports from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Tanzania has been taking the same measures against coronavirus as other African nations, closing schools, quarantining foreign arrivals, and banning public events. But while President John Magufuli's government has argued social distancing, it has come under fire from critics for refusing to close down houses of worship. At a Sunday service this week, Magufuli said the virus is satanic and therefore cannot thrive in churches. The chairman of the opposition Civic United Front Party, Ibrahim Lipumba, tells VOA that government statements on the virus should focus on prevention. Precautions should be faced, says Lipumba, even if all people may not be ill. If people contract the virus and if the people continue with the crowds and gatherings, he says there'll be a great danger. Abdul Nondo is a young representative for the Alliance for Change and Transparency Party. Speaking via messaging app, he notes that Magufuli's statement goes against World Health Organization guidance.
Hii inaashiria kwamba ugonjwa huu Tanzania bado haujakithiri.
Nondo says this indicates the disease has not hit Tanzania hard, and that's why people are making a joke of it and making such statements. But the disease has a lot of negative effects, he says. adding that a country like Italy was hit hard by the disease because they delayed taking strong measures. Supporters say the Tanzanian president's vow to keep churches open is designed to comfort people and prevent fear over coronavirus. But it also risks discouraging the public from taking preventive measures seriously. Dar es Salaam's resident Joel Majula says after Magufuli's comments on churches, he's less afraid of the virus. He says many citizens, including himself, take it as a normal disease because when we go to mosques and churches and wash our hands, we believe that is the best way to prevent the disease. Majula says they don't believe people gathering together could bring negative effects. Tanzania is not the only country grappling with concerns over religious gatherings. In many countries, churches, mosques, and other institutions are holding services online or cancelling them altogether. But some religious leaders insist on going ahead as normal. In the U.S. state of Louisiana, one church defied the state governor's advice and held a service last Sunday that attracted more than 1,800 people. Health experts have warned that social distancing is essential to limiting the spread of the coronavirus, which has killed more than 25,000 people worldwide and infected more than 500,000. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
The numbers of cases of the coronavirus are rising across Africa. Critics say African governments are not doing enough to stop the disease. Others note that even advanced countries are finding it difficult to tame the disease. But concerned worldwide, a global humanitarian organization focused on the world's most vulnerable says its teams are preparing to assist communities in some of the world's poorest countries to battle COVID-19. For more about the efforts by the organization to help African government to combat the disease, I reach Concerned Worldwide CEO Dominic Maxoli.
Concerned Worldwide has been around for about 50 years. We're currently operating in 24 of the world's poorest countries. Many of these caught up in hunger, many of these caught up in conflict. This crisis, and we are an organization that's used to crisis, is unprecedented. It has hit every country, every aspect of what we do. Our home offices in the US, in Ireland, in London and South Korea have been the first to be affected. And now we are looking at the increasing scale and transmission rates that we're seeing across Africa. Now, here's the thing. Our core priority at the minute is to the safety and protection of our staff. We put a lot of measures in place. The second thing is, to the extent possible, of continuing to run the life-saving programs where we're providing support to displaced populations, whether it's in South Sudan, in Syria, nutrition, water, sanitation. How can we keep those going while at the same time contributing to the scaling up of strategies to reduce the transmission? It's a huge challenge.
So how is your organization cooperating with Africans in the fight against this coronavirus?
Throughout all the countries we're working in, we are working with Ministry of Health in close partnership with them and the various emergency coordination committees that have been established by government. Let's just take the Democratic Republic of Congo just as one example. I mean, I think they have 40 or 50 cases, but I think everybody recognises that this is really the tip of the iceberg, that there are going to be many more cases coming. Kinshasa at the minute is in lockdown. The population, as you know, is in excess. It's 80-90 million. And there are currently 45 ventilators in country. So this is a huge, massive challenge. Now, look, we're doing some of the things that we just come out of Ebola. We're redirecting the teams with the Ministry of Health and turning their attention now to COVID. Here's some things that we know that we can help with. You know, it is some of this basic stuff about washing hands, providing soap, ensuring that people are doing the very basic hygiene. The second thing is community mobilization. Now, I think a lot of this with COVID, which is a real challenge, is using text messaging, SMS, to try and get the messages out. The third thing that we did actually very successfully was work with the Ministry of Education in Sierra Leone and Liberia to get kids continue to learning over the radio and adapting curriculum. And this is the kind of stuff now we're looking at in DRC. So there's a lot that can be done and we're working very much in partnership with the various ministries. But there is a huge challenge ahead. particularly in terms of resources, PPE, all of the kind of things that the health systems are lacking, have been lacking, and definitely need.
So far, what are some of the challenges your organization is facing in view of working with some of these Ministry of Health of these African countries?
So I think a real challenge is, you know, many of the countries that we're working in throughout Africa are adopting clearly and rightly the WHO guidelines. So this is about, you know, lockdown. It's about distancing. It's about hand washing. It's about testing. And it's about referral. But, you know, in truth, we know that social distancing is a real, real problem in urban areas or in displaced camps, you know, in South Sudan. So I think what we're trying to do is there's also been, you know, guidelines out to say that no more than 20 or 50 people can gather at any one time. However, we're trying to do distributions of food, of shelter materials, of hygiene kits to populations, you know, at about 10,000. You know, it's very hard for us to do effective distributions for small numbers of 20 or 50. So we've been working with different governments saying, look, if we can mitigate the transference of COVID within larger distributions, can we work with you on that? So I think that's the thing, is about trying to do a humanitarian response within fairly strict government guidelines that we understand, but just trying to balance that. So far, I think there's an openness in certain areas, but, you know, we really are going to have to prioritise some of the, as the cases rise, we have to go back and ensure that people have food, shelter, water, as much as we do protection about COVID-19.
So how do you overcome some of these challenges, particularly where you have countries with pretty much non-existent of health infrastructure to handle this in spite of the WHO guidelines that they have embraced so far?
Okay, the key message that we have here is we've got to the extent possible not just to treat COVID. We have to keep to the extent possible the kind of health programs, maternal child health, nutrition, education. All of these have to keep going to the extent possible. The second message around this is, you know, people's own behaviour is a critical barrier to transmission. And I think the third message, kind of at the political level, you know, where we're seeing in many countries where businesses have been shut down that are not regarded as essential. So, you know, food businesses, banking is kept open. But in certain countries that we're operating in, international NGOs, national NGOs, humanitarian assistance programs have not been categorized as essential. They have to be categorized as essential because they are the ones that can go in and do the frontline work, and they have to be resourced. Those are the messages. We have a critical window of opportunity, right? We are already in the throes of this across Europe. Africa is not there yet. We have a couple of weeks. We need to scale up and prevent so that we're not experiencing the same right across Africa, because many of the countries do not have the same health facilities, and this could be a much greater disaster than it needs to be.
Dominic Maxolli is the Chief Executive Officer of Concern Worldwide. He spoke with me from Dublin, Ireland.
Listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Kote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
na misi na tafauti na we. Why kiki mi na mimi sina shida na we. Kabulu jakuwa apande una anzi ya kuwa mwana inchi. Kabula kuni umiza tigiliza neno langu. Shida ziko kwangu pia nazo ziko kwako. I'm fighting for you and for me. Watoto wangu na watoto wako wasome vizuri wapate future njema.
something else you want, something else you need. Yeah. I don't need any plants, I don't need any seed. Huh? Oh, allow me make a court, make a three by three. Yeah. Come by, you be shade for the family.
Please love me for me, na na na. Sweetie, on this sugar daddy, na na na. Please love me for me, na 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 na. Sweetie, on this sugar daddy, na na na. Congo sabi and you talk boku boku, talk waiting you no do, just for.
Katika, 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 Katika. katika nina midadi kaya rumba kibao kata kinyonga mfuko nina mavumba lungu nichi nina sunta yani bo 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 kana niko shaga ro o o o yani nasimama dede dede kakitingisha wo 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 wo.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally and reporter and producer Douglas Impuga. And remember, as the elders say, when children are learning to walk and fall down over 50 times, they never think to themselves, maybe this isn't for me. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.